All right. Okay. We are we're going to look a little bit at step 10 right now, if that's okay with everybody. You know, one of the things I want to talk about just before we move into step 10 is, I guess everybody in here has been exposed to the 12 promises of AA, right? A lot of meetings that you go to, read them, you know, you'll know a new freedom and a new happiness. We'll be amazed before we're halfway through. We'll not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door. We know these promises by heart. The thing is what they leave out when they put these promises on the wall or they read them as the 12 promises is they leave out the fact that these promises will materialize for you before you're halfway through the ninth step. Don't think that these promises are just going to happen through osmosis because you're going to a lot of meetings. These promises happen as a result of spiritual action. Like the promises that we've covered prior to this. Where there's an action step, there's usually a set of promises. There's usually a set of experiences that we're going to have in common after we've taken these steps, done this work. And again, the ninth step promises are touted as the 12 promises in AA. I've got two problems with that. One problem is there's a whole hell of a lot more than 12 promises in AA. They're shortchanging you. The other problem I have with it is they don't put it in context. You need to understand this stuff in context. And in context, before you're halfway through the ninth step, these promises will materialize if you work for them. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory, continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commenced this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We have entered the world of the spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. You know, there's a whole lot of stuff in step 10. A ton of stuff is packed into step 10. I see step 10 is related a lot to that part of step 12 where it tells us we need to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Step 10 really is kind of practicing the step principles in a reactive way. When things crop up in our lives, when we have challenges, when we have opportunities, we're supposed to use the lessons that we've learned in the prior steps and the lessons we're going to learn in step 11 and 12, and we're supposed to be able to apply them in real life situations in real time. That's kind of what step 10 is talking about. We need to start acting like recovered individuals out there. Because so much of our recovery is contingent on our behavior. You know, it talks in step 10 about a lot of very, very powerful things. We've entered the world of the spirit. There's a piece in this book which says, ask yourself what spiritual terms mean to you. What does it mean to have entered the world of the spirit? You know, at the next discussion meeting, why don't you bring that out as a topic? I'd like everybody to share on what's their experience entering the world of the spirit and see how many crazy, you know, topics, crazy responses you're going to get for that. This whole thing is spiritual. The whole series of steps is spiritual, and it's designed to get us in touch with a power greater than ourselves. It's designed to help us unblock ourselves from a proper way of living and a proper way of relating ourselves to the universe and in personal relationships and everything else. You know, what is the world of the spirit? What does that mean to you? It can mean a lot of things. Some of the great promises in this book are we'll intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle you. I love that promise because intuition can be seen as part of the realm of the spirit. To intuitively know something is to know it without conscious thought. You know, like women's intuition, they've heard about that for 1,000 years. It's That you just know. You know, there's no reason why you should know. You just kind of know. You know without conscious thought, sometimes without actual proof. You know, when we move into the world of the Spirit, we are going to intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. You know what we'll be able to do too, which is amazing? We'll intuitively know how to handle sponsees that would normally baffle us. You know, that's a great application of this principle. Oh, man. I'll tell you what, before I had experience with the steps, I sponsored people. You know, one of the first things I learned was how to give good share. You know, how to sound good in meetings. Because that seemed to be very important in the meetings that I was going to. You know, people who were a little bit funny, a little bit self-deprecating, you know, were not too challenging and kept it to themselves and how stupid they were that day with some silly little thing. Those are the people that, you know, people really enjoyed when they shared and they would pat them on the head. So I started to learn how to give good share in these meetings. So people mistakenly thought that I actually had a clue, and they would come up and they would ask me to sponsor them. And my pat answer was, sure, what do you want me to do? I mean, can you imagine? This is like my first year I started sponsoring people. And I found, you know, we're going to get into this more tomorrow when we're talking about step 12. But I found that until you have experience with something, it's very, very difficult to pass it on. You know, the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. It talks about that in this step. The spiritual life is something that needs to be lived. It needs to be practiced. As an alcoholic and a, you know, a pseudo-intellectual alcoholic, I also have read tractor trailer loads of books. I love to learn things intellectually and not have to go out on the playing field with them. You know what I mean? Like, just give me the book on, you know, meditation for dummies. I'll know 45 different ways to meditate. You know, will I actually do them all? Well, no. But, you know, I'll be able to speak intelligently on them. You know? I mean, that's the wrong way to approach this stuff. We need to put this stuff into practice, and we need to actually live it. And you know what? We don't have to do it perfectly. We really don't. We can botch it up. I would rather botch something up real bad than wait until I can do it perfect in the spiritual world, because, you know, we get the benefits of our actions. A lot of times we don't get the benefits of our intentions or our knowledge. You know, lack of knowledge is not our problem. Lack of intention is not our problem. Lack of power is our problem. And we get the power by applying these spiritual principles. And a wonderful step is step 10. We continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Continue to watch for that. You know, this is a great exercise. I give this to my sponsees. I'll say, look, take a week. And what I want you to do is I want you to stay aware. I want you to stay conscious of one of these things and watch for it. So you're going to watch for fear, or you're going to watch for resentment. You're going to watch for dishonesty. You're going to watch for selfishness. And when these things crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. That's an incredibly valuable skill set to possess as an alcoholic. Because what happens is when you do this, you catch things before they start rolling downhill, gaining momentum and weight. You know what I mean? You catch it before it has a chance to continue to hurt you and hurt you and hurt you. Looking back on the things that hurt me in my life with my resentments and my fears, I could never break away. If you did something, or if I perceived that you did something to me, I held on to that the rest of my life. You know what I mean? I used to tell people I'm German, and that's why I did it. But what it was I was alcoholic, and that's why I did it. I was going to get you. You know, it might take me 10 years, 20 years, but I'll, you know, so rather than let something like that sit in my consciousness and corrode my spiritual condition, Step 10 is asking me to apply the disciplines that I've learned and will learn with the rest of the steps in an immediate fashion. I'll give you a for instance in application. There was something that happened to me not too long ago, and what it was I made a decision based on self which caused some problems in the future. What it was there was a high school principal that wanted me to do some things, and I reasoned that, I'll tell you what, instead of doing that, I'm going to do this other thing because that's going to work out better, and he'll probably be fine with it anyway and forget he asked me anyway. And so I went ahead and I did what I wanted to do, not what he asked me to do. It's only his school. And what happened was he got wind of it. He saw what I did. He understood that I was acting, against his wishes and not following a chain of command and all this other stuff. And I immediately went into his office when I recognized that this was becoming a problem. And I told him exactly what I did. I said, this is exactly what I did. I understood exactly what you asked me to do. I thought by doing this, not only would it solve your problem, but it would solve mine. I was wrong. And that's an immediate application of these principles. We don't want to wait till the end of the year when we do inventory to catch some of this stuff. We want to take care of this in real time so that we can stay spiritually fit. Remember what it said on page 174 of the step book. We drink because of our disobedience to spiritual principles. So these must become habits to us. They must become habitual. These examples of how to operate in a spiritual way, in a moral way. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts towards someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. Now that's a big paragraph. That one paragraph there is asking us to do a whole lot of stuff. And then right away they start to give us some of the promises that are going to come. If we've worked our way up through and are starting to apply step 10 in our life, there are some amazing promises. Now these are not the promises you see up on the wall. These are not the promises that are referred to as the 12 promises of AA, but they're extraordinary. Listen to some of these promises. We've ceased fighting anything or anyone. Can you imagine that? Do you think that's what they mean? We ceased fighting anything or anyone? Even our family? Even our coworkers? Even our home group members? During the slow, painful business meetings? Cease fighting anything or anyone, our children? Is that what this could mean? For by this time, sanity will have returned. That's pretty good news. Remember in the second step, it talks about being restored to sanity. This is when it happens. It happens, here in the 10-step promises, that we will be restored to sanity. The type of sanity that they're talking about is alcoholic insanity, which is power, choice, and control. The ability to control when we put alcohol in our body is basically what they're talking about. If we can think sanely and normally about alcohol, then we can think sanely and normally that we better not put it in our bodies. And that's what happens. The power greater than ourselves is working in us and through us and enabling us to think sanely and normally where it concerns alcohol. And we now have a defense. A power greater than ourselves is the defense from putting another drink in our body. We'll seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally. We find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That's the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. So basically, Bill is saying 16 different ways that the alcohol problem has been removed. Now, does that mean we're not an alcoholic anymore? Absolutely not. Does that mean we're cured of alcoholism? Absolutely not. But the problem has been removed, and it'll give us some specifics in a few minutes. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We've not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That's our experience. This is how we react as so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. Here it is again. It's our job to keep in fit spiritual condition. I don't even think we can do that without God's help. But if we ask God to help us stay in fit spiritual condition and to seek to grow in knowledge and understanding of his will, you know, that's God does not make too hard terms for those who seek him. The hoop you have to jump through is larger than you think it is, and you have a real good shot by this time of achieving conscious contact with and a power with the God of your understanding, and to be able to experience the power that becomes available with that relationship that can keep you in this safe and protected state. But there's some qualifications here. You know, it's not like your problem's been removed. Don't worry about it. You can leave AA and go back to the Rotary Club. That's not basically what they're saying. They're saying it's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. Laurels are yesterday's accomplishments. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Here it is again. Contingent on our maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts and prayers which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we want. It is the proper use of the will. Step 10 is an amazing step. Step 10 is practicing the principles in all of our affairs, in all time, in real time. And step 10 is a way to broaden and deepen our relationship with God. If we continue to apply step 10, we are going to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This isn't about a steady state. This isn't. Some people have described step 10 and 11 as maintenance state steps. That can be true, but I think they're bigger than that. I think they're growth steps. And when we continue to practice these things, we're going to grow in understanding and effectiveness. We're going to grow spiritually. We're going to enlarge our spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others. We're going to do. We're going to be about the right business, and all of that is going to contribute to our part of the maintenance of our spiritual condition. You know, our part of the deal. Remember the deal we made in step 3. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as I will. We made a deal in step 3. We made a deal to be, you know, on God's team, helping God's children. Every single one of the steps, the third step, the seventh step prayer, it's all about help me to be more effective helping other people. That's our part of the bargain. That's why we have to be available. We have to be willing to help the still sick and suffering alcoholic. That's why we have to be willing to answer the phone at 2 a.m. with somebody who's on some psychotic rant, wanting to kill themselves or something, that's why we have to go to the detox and, you know, listen to the insane drunks, you know, talking about their drama. We got to be willing to do a lot of these things because we need to be available. We need to be present to fulfill our part of the bargain. God's part of the bargain is to relieve us of this bondage of self, to help place us in a position where we can grow in effectiveness and understanding and heal. You know, we're not ever going to be cured of alcoholism, but we can get to the point where we're recovered from it. We can be recovered without necessarily being cured. And I'll tell you what, I want to be in a state known as recovered. That's where I want to live, because I'll say this again. I don't mind dying with alcoholism. I don't want to die from it. Go ahead.
Well, I'm a little bit more of a stickler when it comes to step 10 than Chris is, because it's been my belief, and I was raised up, that the instructions of the book are the instructions of the book, so you do exactly what it says. So let me give you like a little bit of a real-time thing of what doing a 10-step looks like, right? One, My sponsor had me, and I had the women I sponsor start reading 80-40-88 when they're writing their four-step. So we continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear when they crop up, right? I hate reading with the mic. I have to be over here, so here we go. Okay. So we continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When they crop up, we ask God to remove them. So I watch. My job in the 10th step is to be aware and awake, to stay awake and to be present in this moment. When I realize that I lost contact with the present moment is when I'm in fear, right? And we know what fear feels like. We feel that anxiety in the pit of our stomachs. So my job is to pay attention, to be present, to be in my body in the right here and right now, and watch my reactions. At first, I don't even really know what I'm thinking because my mind is owning me. My mind is screaming at me all the time, right? So what I'm really watching for is the physical reactions to the things that are going on in my mind. When we think about something that's unpleasant, we have that visceral anxiety sense, right? And I watch for that experience, and I say, what's going on here? I watch for that reaction, and I say, I'm uncomfortable. When I'm uncomfortable, it was taught to me that, I am my problem, you are my solution. So if I'm uncomfortable, it has to do with me. There must be something going on within me that is causing my discomfort. So where am I being selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, frightened, inconsiderate, right? So I watch for these things going on in me. Now, at this point, I've been watching and pausing and watching and pausing for quite a long time. So I don't necessarily have to get to the point where I have a physical anxiety reaction to my thoughts. My thoughts will float through my mind. I recognize them, see them, say, wow, that's a selfish thought, and it goes. But my job is to become present to the things that are going on in my mind. Because when I'm not present to the thoughts that I have, my thoughts own me because I give them power. Because I create a reality based, or a story, a reality based on whatever thought that I'm having. If I'm not aware of what I'm thinking, there's nothing that I can do about it. So my job is to wake up to my reactions to things that are going on in my mind. So if I'm having an interaction with my husband, my child, my boss, a coworker, a friend, sponsee, whatever, I watch for how I'm reacting to what's going on. I watch within me, because we have a watcher and we have a walker. Do you ever hear of that concept, the watcher and the walker? Our walker is, the person who goes through our life. And the watcher is that spiritual being that kind of floats up above everything that's going on. And that's that God kernel that I was talking to you about, our soul or spirit, chi, whatever you want to call it. There's that spiritual energy that observes what's going on in the right here, right now, right? So our job in step 10 is to wake up to and pay attention to these things. First, we pay attention to our body because a lot of times our mind is so loud, we can't pick out the thoughts or the things that are disturbing us. So we pay attention to what's going on with us physically. Once we experience something physically, we can stop and say, well, I just had an anxiety reaction. What was I thinking that provoked that? What was the delusion attached to that thought that provoked the anxiety reaction? Because I was taught that if I'm in fear, right, then I'm in delusion. Because fear is ultimately delusional because it's based in an all or nothing proposition. Fear is always, always a lie because there's always an exception to everything. And fear tells me that there isn't. Fear tells me about tomorrow. Fear tells me about yesterday. Fear doesn't exist in this present moment because you can't really be afraid of the present moment because nothing is going on in the present moment. The only thing that's going on in the present moment is the right here, right now, right? I can't have any fear about that because I'm just here breathing. I'm just here being. My fear, when it's attached to my thoughts, have to do with what's going to happen 5 minutes from now, 10 minutes from now, 2 weeks from now, next year. That has absolutely nothing to do with where I'm at. So the first thing I do in step 10 is I stop. What am I thinking? What am I experiencing? What delusions are going on with this thought process? A really good tip is called the foot check. You ever do the foot check? I worked with paranoid schizophrenics and people with schizoaffective disorder for a really, really long time, and they get in a lot of anxiety. You know, they think, you know, they're checking the windows to see, you know, like the, you know, the aliens are coming in to probe them and things like that. So I'll stop them and I'll say, "Where are you? Look down at your feet. Where are your feet?" "Well, I'm in the living room." "Where are you in the living room?" "Well, I'm in the living room at, you know, 1234, you know, West End Avenue." "Okay. Where's West End Avenue?" "Whitehall, Pennsylvania." "What day is it?" "You know, July 4th. "What year?" "Blah, blah, blah." "Does what you're thinking about have anything to do with where you are right now, where your feet are in this time, in this place?" "No?" "Ignore it. Ignore it. It's none of my business." So I watch for my reactions. And as I get better at watching my reactions, I can watch my thoughts, because I begin to realize and see and become awake to what I'm thinking. And thoughts, like anything else, I mean, trying to control your thoughts, you know, that's like trying to herd cats with hoses. There's no point to it. Let them go. They're just thoughts. If I don't give them any validity, if I don't give them any power, they have no power over me. They're weather. I watch for them. I pause. When something disturbs me, I ask God to remove them. Then what do? I discuss them immediately. I pick up the phone. I have 10-step buddies. That's what we call them, 10-step. This is what I said. I'm a little bit more literal than you. Pick up the phone. Okay, so I'm being selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened, and somebody's not doing what I want, right? I watched myself react to that. I saw the thought process that was attached to that. I asked God to remove it. I pick up the phone at an appropriate time or place. Like, you know, you don't pick it up in front of your boss and be like, "By the way, my boss isn't doing what he wants or what I want." I take a moment. I go in the ladies' room. Whatever I got to do, I pick up the phone. I call someone. I say, "I'm being selfish and self-centered. People aren't doing what I want. I'm in fear. I want to control the situation. I ask God to remove it. What can I do to be of service to you today?" Click. We're 10-step buddies. I'm not calling up with drama. I'm not here to hash out my second column. What I'm doing is I'm calling somebody, turning my thoughts to someone else. It says, we discuss them immediately with someone and make amends quickly if we have harmed anyone. If there is a corrective action that needs to be taken, take it. Boom. Boom. Now. Next. Now. Stay on top of it. Present moment. Now. Now. Because here's the other thing is when I start to procrastinate, when there's an amend, a corrective action that needs to be taken based on thought or selfishness or dishonesty that I experienced and I reacted to what was going on in my head because I lost my place in time in the present moment and I reacted to something, then I behaved in a certain way that harms you. If I avoid cleaning up that mess in the, right here, right now, you know what happens? I create a story about it. And I create another story about it. And then I'm rationalizing, I'm creating this story, and I'm prolonging something that could have been taken care of with a few words. "Gee, I'm really sorry I snapped off at you." In fact, my husband called me while my GPS was going wonky in traffic in Manhattan yesterday, and he's trying to tell me how to drive on top of the GPS on my phone, and I stopped. I was like, "I can't talk to you right now. I'm stuck in traffic." Click. 2 seconds later, "I'm really sorry I reacted that way. I apologize. I shouldn't have snapped at you." That simple. It doesn't have to be that hard. But the idea here is this, is that a lot of times I've experienced or I've worked with people who do the 10-step in their mind. And doing the 10-step in their mind without following the literal instructions, a lot of times what happens is they're holding on to all kinds of things. Holding on to all kinds of things. So they're 10-stepping. They're seeing what they're selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. They're asking God to remove them, but they're not doing the other part of that, which is speaking to somebody and taking constructive action. So there's that whole gamut that goes into the 10th step. You know, and I found that when I applied that discipline to my life, it's amazing how incredible my relationships became, how much less I reacted to the things that went on in my head, and how present I was able to become. Because this step really is, and it really is about the present moment. It's about being here right now and not losing contact with that. And the thing is that we're people, we're human, we lose contact. I lose contact with that all the time. And when my mind wanders off into the future or wanders back into the past, I watch for that, and that has absolutely nothing to do with what's going on right now. It's none of my business. Boom. God, remove it. Admit it to somebody. Keep going. Boom. Make amends if it's necessary. I've been in class where I've turned to the person next to me and I said, I'm judging the crap out of the professor. I'm being selfish and self-centered, and I want things to go to my way. Is there anything I can do to be of service to you today? And they looked at me and said, no. Cool. Boom. Done. It's amazing how these things, and it's also amazing how much, when you practice this, how much the fellowship of the Spirit continues to grow, because we're sharing with one another, we're being human with one another, we're not putting up fronts or pretending to be spiritual giants, we're being human beings, having a human experience together, working together. So I have these 10-step buddies, and I'm a 10-step buddy with a bunch of people, and I get phone calls all the time, text messages for people at work. I love the text message, the 10-step text message. Dude, it works wonderfully. Step into the bathroom. Make that quick phone call, man. It is amazing how much that tiny step makes such a huge difference in terms of whether or not I'm going to carry this around or whether I can get back into the present moment. When I first started practicing this, I had to make 10 or 15 phone calls a day. It really sucked. The better I got at this, the more I was able to adhere to this discipline, the less time I had to pick up the phone or turn to some stranger on the street. And it was amazing to me how humbling it was to have to pick up. I'm 10 years sober and I got to make 15 phone calls because my kids are pissing me off. But how amazing it was, how humbling it was, how invigorating it was, and how incredible it was in my relationships. So this is something that I don't think I can overemphasize the practical application of this. And it really has to do, the 10th step is not something you do at night. That's the 11th step. I hear that all the time. People say, well, I do my 10th step at night. Really? Because the Nightly Review says, step 11 suggests prayer and meditation, and then we have those 12 questions. But there's an amazing thing. In those 12 questions, it asks if we have kept something to ourselves. So it's asking you, in the Nightly Review, did you do a 10 step? Because that's the thing. It's like, I'll see my selfishness. I'll see that stuff, whatever. But God forbid, I humble myself and discuss it with another human being. Ain't doing that. No. So for me, this is a vital part of the discipline of 10 and 11 is turning and sharing. Not my drama, but my fourth column. And there are times during the day where I might have to put pen to paper. I had to do that very early on too. When there was a resentment that came up and I knew I had to write it out. I knew it was something that needed to be written out. Put pen to paper, man. Kill a tree, save your life. Seriously. Why let something grow? Why put off something? Why make it worse? If I see something that's going on, if I see that I actually have a resentment that needs to be written out, if I take the action and write it out right then, right there, make an appointment, fifth step it, get it done, boom. I don't have to create something. I don't have to create wreckage out of that. I can simply take care of it. And it's amazing to me, how many people have, I'll be talking to somebody and they'll be like, well, I have 10, 15 years sober. Well, when's the last time you've been through 1 through 9? Oh, like 8 or 9 years ago. Okay, well, have you been working a perfect 10, 11, and 12? Well, define that. Do you write Nightly Review every night? No. Do morning meditation every day? No. Do you take quiet time at night? No. Do you pause? No. Do you watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear? No. Well, and you want to know why you're fucked up? No, but seriously, think about that for a minute. Think about that for a minute. We do all this incredible work. We make all these incredible amends. We do all of this stuff. We write this beautiful inventory that should be like mounted on the wall. right? We do this powerful fifth step. We start knocking on doors, doing all this stuff, and I don't want to pause. I don't want to tell somebody I'm having a hard time. I don't want to pick up that phone. I don't want to write out a nightly review. I'm too spiritual for that. I've evolved past that. Really? I don't know if the book ever says that we evolve past the disciplines of 10 and 11. That's not been my experience. You know, and this is where our ego will write a check that our spirit can't cash. And it's been my experience when I stay in these disciplines and I do exactly what they say. I'm a literal, fundamental, letter of the law sort of big book person. I don't make stuff up. I don't take things away. You know, I talked about it last night, and I'll kind of wrap it up with this. No, talked about it last night. I said that, you know, this is a recipe, right? This is a recipe for a spiritual experience. Like, we can add stuff, but we don't take it away. And it's amazing to me how much in 10 and 11 people take things away. How much, you know, how much we get so busy living and doing and whatever that we stop to do the very things. You know, it's like this. And, I have a sponsee who's MR, so, like, sometimes I have to, like, break down, you know, the concepts of the big book and the steps in a very, very simple way for her to understand it. And I was talking about the necessity for a relationship with God. You know, I was really talking about the second step, but I was trying to put it in a very simple way. And I asked her, I said, well, you know, when you meet somebody on the street and you know, you're introduced to them, do they become your friend? And she was like, well, yeah, you know, people I know are my friends. I said, yeah, but how do you get to know them? Well, I talk to them. So, you know, you have to pick up the phone, you have to go to meetings, or you maybe meet them for coffee, and you have interactions, and you talk to them, right? Yeah, that's how you have a friend. I said, well, what about God? Is God your friend? Well, yeah. I said, do you talk to him? No. You know, it's amazing to me how much, you know, I'll do all this work, I'll have all these spiritual experiences, and then I'll stop in that relationship, that interaction with God, where I start and I pull back and I was like, well, thanks God for saving me from the alcoholic, you know, death. Thank you so much for bringing me back from the gates of hell. Thank you so much for restoring me to sanity. Thank you so much. I'll see you later. Bye. So, you know, our relationship with God is truly a relationship and it requires effort and communication. It requires prayer and meditation. It requires being conscious and aware of when my ego starts to cut God out and take over. And really, that's what the 10 steps are all about, is about being awake to that. Being awake to when my ego begins to take over and I begin to recreate reality in my image. When I start to become the creator instead of having a creator. And we stay awake to that by staying awake to the present moment and watching for these things. And I want you to close your eyes for a minute. Everybody close your eyes. And just take a couple deep breaths. Okay. Did you guys observe any thoughts, any reactions, anything going on within your body, within your mind, while you were taking those couple deep breaths? Were there something that flowed through, just an idea, you know, anything? Okay. See, that thing that you experienced that floated through, that was the walker. And the thing that observed it is the watcher. And what we try to do with the 10th step is go through our day with the watcher, watching the walker but not engaging in it. And when we engage the walker, we pause. We ask God to take it away. We turn. We ask. We speak. This is what we do. And if we can do this on a daily basis, when we can watch for these things, when we can be awake to them, we never have to fall asleep again. It might get away from us for a moment, but we can always bring it back. We never have to go to sleep. We never have to be in the coma. You never have to go back into the matrix. I always think about that when we talk about falling asleep, you know, being asleep, dreaming that you're awake. I think about the matrix, right? You guys ever watch the matrix? Or am I just a dork? Okay. You know, the matrix you're plugged in, and you know the matrix dictates your reality, right? When you wake up, you realize that, you know, the world is full of suffering. It's not perfect, and you know, food isn't as wonderful, and things are cold, and it's kind of scary. Machines run the entire world, and you're basically a battery for their, like, you know, cities, right? But in the matrix, you're comfy and you're soft and you're all these things, but nothing and everything you experience is not real. It's all part of the reality created for you to keep you asleep and to keep you a slave, right? Reality is difficult and uncomfortable. We face things about ourselves. We see things about ourselves that kind of suck sometimes. Sometimes we have to be the bigger person. I can remember going to my sponsor like, why do I have to make the amend? Because you can. Why do you have to be the bigger person? Because you can. You know, being awake doesn't mean that it's always, you know, puppy dogs and sunshine and rainbows. Sometimes it's about taking it on the chin. Sometimes it's about letting go of what we want. What I want does not matter. Letting go of those attachments, not always being perfect, not always looking good. But for me, I would rather have the discomfort of being awake at times to the things that are going on within me than falling asleep and being the slave to my mind again. Because my mind does not own me, and just because I think it doesn't mean that it is real. I have this thing, and I'll finish up with this. I have like this thing where I think I'm fat. All women think they're fat, right? And my husband wants to kill me. I've had 4 children, and I'm really, really not fat. But I have this obsession that I am because my mind tells me that I am. And he'll look at me some days, and he'll be like, really? And you're gonna, since when did you start listening to your mind? Oh, good point. My mind tells me I'm fat. That does not make me fat. My perception is distorted. And when I can wake up and be aware of that truth, I don't have to react to it. It does not have to become my truth. I don't have to own it, but I have to be awake to it. And that takes effort on our part. Chris, you want to?
Sure. Step 11. Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. It says we shouldn't be shy in this matter. Prayer and meditation are incredibly powerful tools in getting connected to the great reality, you know, connecting our consciousness in the correct way to an understanding of spirituality and a power greater than ourselves. And, you know, when it's done, Bill this morning gave a great kind of Dharma talk on the power of meditation and what it is and why it's useful and why we should be doing it. And, I won't expand any more on that except to say that when I miss my morning meditation and prayer, it's actually been a long time since I've missed it. But I was basically given the same test as Bill was talking about by my first sponsor. He explained to me what he wanted me to do in the morning and what he wanted me to do at night. And then he told me this. He said, there are going to be days that you forget to do this. Just pay attention to the quality of the days that you do it, mm-hmm. and the quality of the days that you don't. Because sometimes we have to be shown. You know, sometimes we have, we're the type of people, you need to prove it to us sometimes, especially early on, because we just can't understand why prayer and meditation is going to improve our life. So we have to be convinced to do it. And I was convinced to do it. And for my first 3 or 4 months, there would be days I would forget to do it, days that I would do it. And it was unbelievably the difference between those 2 days. I could get through pretty well the days that I did my prayer meditation, and there was always some debacle on the days that I didn't. And I started to think, you know, that my sponsor was jinxing me or something, you know, because it was that apparent, the difference. So, you know, the book is suggesting prayer and meditation. The book is telling us that we need to develop this, you know, to head toward the sixth sense that they talk about. There's a couple of sections in here. I'm going to start with on awakening. On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. So there's some instructions on how to get up in the morning, how to start your day. You know, when you research a little bit about the Oxford Group and how they would do their morning quiet time, you know, you start to get a little bit of an understanding of where Bill pulled this stuff from. I would highly recommend anybody that's really into prayer and meditation or into understanding it more, look into some of the early Oxford Group practices, because Bill kept some of it, but he also changed some of it. And it's kind of fun just to go back to see, well, what was he doing when he was out there with Dr. Bob and Ann Smith in Akron for those 4 or 5 months? What were they doing? And there's evidence in a number of areas of exactly what they were doing. But I think we do have to plan. I think we do have to think about what's going on. Okay, I've got 3 meetings today. I need to be at work at 9 o'clock. You know, some of that is about being effective, effective managers of our time and our responsibilities. And it basically says, in thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration, intuitive thought, or decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We're often surprised how the right answers come if we have tried this for a while. What used to be a hunch or an occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. I love this. We're developing the intuitive part of our mind. We're developing, you know, as an inspiration, we're developing an ability to understand the right thought or the right action, to gain access to that wisdom, you know, to gain access to some of the divine. Being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it's not probable we're going to be inspired at all times. What it's basically saying here is we need to practice this. It needs to become a daily discipline. You know, some of the people that were my spiritual mentors would pound home every time they talked about step 10 and step 11. They would pound home discipline, the disciplines of step 10 and 11, the disciplines of step 10, the disciplines of upon awakening, the disciplines of the disciplines of, you know, as we move through our day. And we really do, we need to become disciplined at this. You do anything like 60 times in a row and it becomes kind of a habit. Sometimes we have to push ourselves in that same direction. We conclude the period of meditation with a prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be. We be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. We ask especially for freedom from self-will. And we're careful to make no requests for ourselves only. We may ask for ourselves if others will be helped. We're careful never to pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us have wasted a lot of time doing that, and it doesn't work. You can see why. Then there's kind of a forgotten paragraph here that asks us to bring our family or our wives or our husbands into this particular devotion. The early Oxford Group members had the whole family would do morning quiet time together. You know, we're so fractured in, you know, today's modern families. You got 6 people living in the same house. They're all split and going in different directions 100 miles an hour. You know, if it's possible to gather everybody, to herd up the cats and get everybody to do this, you can probably have a really, really cool experience with the family when you do this. I certainly have. As we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful, asking for the right thought or action. Don't just do something. Stand there. You know, that's pretty revolutionary, isn't it? I mean, I always used to just shoot from the hip. You know, I perceive somebody doing me wrong, and, you know, I'd throw a hand grenade in the middle of it all. You know, I mean, I was nuts. And today, I'm involved in some really high-level management, and I've got union people that work for me, and I've got maintenance and management and contractors, and there's people in and out of my office, like, like every second I'm answering emails. I've got two phones in my ear. There's people waiting to get into my office because they've got some problem. And, you know, I've learned not to react emotionally, to really pause and take time to understand the situation. And if something really upsets me, I try, this is a habit, I try to not make a decision on it, unless I absolutely have to, not make a decision on it until the next day. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know about anybody else, but I've actually been known to make emotional decisions. You know, that end up shooting myself in the foot later on, you know. And through the pain of multiple experiences of these things, and the spiritual process that they talk about in here, I've kind of learned to maybe pause when agitated or doubtful, maybe put off a decision to fire somebody or something, you know. I do that, and it usually works out. And a lot of times I gain perspective with a little bit of time. I see things a little bit more clearly and not clouded by emotion. It talks in here about suggestions about books. Get some suggestions from priests, ministers, or rabbis about religious or spiritual books. Listen, you know, this is back in the day, they didn't have the spiritual sections in the bookstore. You go into a Barnes & Noble now, you got religion, you got spirituality, you got self-help. You got all these different sections. You go onto Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble online, oh my God, can you find some stuff? I usually suggest to the people that I work with to trust their instincts on some of this stuff. Like, I'll hand them a couple of the spiritual classics that, you know, everybody reads. But I'll basically say, look, you know, find your own path with spiritual literature. All I want you to do is read it. I'm kind of unconcerned about which ones you read, but I think it's important for you to start exploring some of the lessons and some of the wisdom of some of the enlightened masters of the past. There's an incredible wealth of information and experience to be had from some of the enlightened masters of the past and present, really. And we can gain a lot of wisdom, a lot of positive operational methodology, and a lot of comfort from the study, and then hopefully the application of these things that we learn. What we learn in this book is the prerequisite. We need to become proficient with this. But then the spiritual life can open up, and you can do anything and everything. You know, a lot of us have gone on meditation retreats. We've gotten spiritual teachers. We look around for more because we just are seekers, and you know that's good. I think that's a good thing. But we need to remember that we need to do all that as well as, not instead of this. I've seen people that have gone so far into left field being spiritual, they're so friggin' spiritual, they're no earthly good anymore. You know, they've spiritualed themselves right out of AA. And half the time they drink, and half the time they become useless when that happens. You know, there's very rarely a positive thing that happens when they spiritual themselves out of AA. So we need to know that, you know, this is our prerequisite. This is essential, you know, essential practice. But there is a lot of wonderful stuff that we can wrap around all this. Then basically when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person? Were we kind and loving toward all? That's one that kind of stumps me. I'm kind of indifferent to many and kind and loving to some. You know, I don't know if I'm ever going to get that one, but what could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. All very constructive, all very progressive, all very attuned to spiritual growth, this particular step. Again, we're going to be better able to work this step. We're going to be better able to experience this step if we've done the steps previous to it. You know, if you've actually done a fourth and a fifth step, if you've actually gone out and made amends. But there is a statement in this book that says that we can begin the practice of step 10 and 11 when we're in amends. Sometimes, you know, sometimes it helps us get through some of the final amends when we start to get down to real discipline with prayer and meditation and the practices of step 10.
Obviously there have been weekends, weeks, months, all kinds of things done on prayer and meditation, you know, and I'm not going to belabor discussing, you know, in 5 minutes or 10 minutes, you know, the plethora of what's out there. But I guess what I want to talk about why it's important and why we need to make it important. And I'll tell you that, you know, like some of my spiritual teachers, like, you know, like guys like, you know, Mark H. and Joe H., they talk about, like, you know, doing prayer meditation for like 2 hours. And I'm like, dude, I got like 4 kids. I'm in grad school. I work full time. I have a husband. So that really means I have 5.5 kids. You know, I got like 13 sponsees. Love you, babe. Got 13 sponsees. Like, I barely have time to breathe. I don't paint my toenails. Seriously, 3 hours of meditation a day. That ain't happening. You know, so, I mean, there's this thing where, like, I like to be realistic about what I can do. You know, my morning meditation is about 15 to 20 minutes every day. It's what, you know, and for me, and this is just me, and I'm truly being honest about this, is my God doesn't make too hard terms with those who seek him. And, you know, and that 20 minutes is precious, but it's 20 minutes. And you know, it's 20 minutes in the morning, about 10 minutes at night doing nightly review. You know, so I'm 30 minutes of prayer and meditation blocked out at the beginning of the day and the end of the day in terms of what I do. I'm never going to get up here and say that I am like, you know, this person who spends like, you know, an entire week in meditation, because I really don't have the luxury of that. But I will tell you that I do this every day. I'll tell you that it's incredibly important to me. And I'll tell you that, you know, for me, I talked about that conversation, that interaction, that transaction between us and God. And what I was saying is that, you know, there's no point in initiating that contact if I'm not willing to continue to maintain it. You know, and this is where we fall asleep again, you know, is when we fail to do these things. You know, and I'll finish it up really quick. The nightly review thing is really, 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 really important. And it's one of those things that, you know, a lot of times, you know, it's another one of those things that people goes by the wayside over time. I don't do a perfect 10-step. I'm never going to do a perfect 10-step. I'm not perfectly awake every second, every moment of the day. But when I can sit down at night and I do this nightly review and I ask God to show me these things and I look at these questions, you know, I'm able to see things that I missed during the day, see where I fell asleep. And I'm able to take care of them and not create wreckage. And a suggestion that I always give people is, a lot of times I get women who have been through the steps, or they claim to have been through the steps like 300 times and they want to have a new experience. So the first thing I do is say, start sending me your nightly review. And they go, oh, yeah, I don't do that. I'm like, well, start doing it. Start sending it to me. And I start reading this. And it's like, I was selfish, but I wasn't dishonest. Lie. Because there's always dishonesty and selfish, because I believe myself entitled to something, which is a delusion, because I'm dictating reality again, remember? So part of that thing, and this is where it's really important, is that try and do this. Like, start, like, emailing or calling in your nightly review to your sponsor once or twice a week. Because it's an awesome thing. When my sponsor gets my nightly review, they get to see what's going on in my mind. So when I'm not awake to stuff, they're like, oh, really, totally? You'd miss that, man. Check that out. And it really helps in terms of, again, broadening and deepening that experience and that humility and sharing that community. So, like, that's another thing that I tend to do. We trade nightly reviews amongst one another, and it's a really awesome experience. I mean, it's something to consider trying. I mean, what's the worst thing that I happen? Somebody can know you're an asshole. Well, they already knew that. Seriously. You're breathing. It happened. You were an ass at some point in your life. So it's something, one of those things that, you know, it does definitely broaden and helps me grow, keeps me accountable. And accountability is an incredible part of what we have to do so that we can stay alive. Because the ego will grab onto absolutely anything and try to kill us. Well, I think we're done for now. Are we going to take a break and then do the Ask It Basket? What was the plan with that? Okay, 15-minute break and then Ask It Basket.